The state of Oregon put new smoke management rules into effect at the beginning of this month. Smoke from wildfires has been a pervasive summer issue in recent years, with weeks of smoke hanging in the air, often at levels that can threaten human health. The rules obviously do not address wildfire smoke because that can't be managed, but they do apply to prescribed burns on forest land in the state. The idea is to provide maximum opportunity for prescribed burns that could avert destructive smoky wildfires during fire season. Let's talk about the rules and the process of making them. Nick Yonkers with the Oregon Department of Forestry, where he is the Smoke Management Program Manager. Nick, thanks for joining us on The Exchange.
Thank you, Jeff.
We also have with us from the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality, DEQ, Michael Orman, the Air Planning Program Manager. Hi, Michael.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Kristen Aird is with us as well from the Oregon Health Authority, where she is the Chronic Disease Manager and the Interim Senior Operations Manager. Kristen, thank you for joining us.
Oh, Jeff, it's good to be here. Thank you.
All right. Thank you all for joining us on this issue. So, Nick, the new rules govern smoke from what? Can you just lay out the general reason for them?
Well, we've got two changes that have taken place, and one is our smoke intrusion definition for how much smoke we can allow into certain communities called smoke sensitive receptor areas has changed, and we do have a community response and communication plan that we're looking to set in place to notify folks of the possibility of more smoke. And the reason for allowing for more smoke to go into communities, not at a unhealthy level, but at a level that's a little bit higher than what we've had in the past, is because we've had a lot of wildfire smoke in the recent years that have caused a lot of problems in communities in the summertime where we don't have much control over that, and getting very unhealthy levels of smoke. And part of the way of preventing wildfire or reducing its size is to use prescribed fire under control situations in the shoulder seasons, which is typically the spring and the fall, when we can control it, determine its size, and how much we want to do on a daily basis. And so we know that we're going to have smoke in our communities during the summertime. Our communities in the West are wildfire environments in the forest and so forth. So we know that our communities are going to get smoke one way or another. We're trying to look at how can we reduce that, reduce the hazard, reduce the smoke, and the way to best do that is through prescribed burning. And that means that there may be a little bit more smoke that goes in a community, but at a level that we can live with, that would be considerably less than what you get with wildfire.
So as has really been talked about for a couple of years now, we're talking about a little more smoke during the non-fire season in the hope of having a lot less in fire season.
That's correct.
So Michael Orban at DEQ, you guys had to take a road trip to collect input, and how long did that go on?
Yeah, so Nick and I did a road trip throughout the state. We spent 2 weeks back in 2018 as part of our public hearing process for the new rules, and met in a number of different locations throughout the state to receive feedback on our rules.
I noticed Medford last August drew a big crowd. Was that typical of the other four meetings in the series?
That was definitely the largest meeting, and it happened to occur during wildfire season as well. So we received a lot of questions about the smoke that we were seeing in town at the prescribed fire rules hearing.
What kind of input then did you get in terms of from the meetings about the concerns of people about having potentially additional smoke outside of fire season in the hope of having less in fire season?
Well, folks were definitely concerned about their health. No smoke is good smoke. And, the fact that we'll have more smoke during the shoulder seasons has some folks concerned. We definitely talked about the balance that we're tasked to seek through the prescribed fire, the smoke management program, in reducing fire risk and also protecting the public from smoke. And, people are concerned that this smoke could have health impacts.
Kirsten Aird, how much did you monitor and did OHA do of smoke health impacts during at least last or any fire season for that matter?
Yeah, that's a great question. We work very closely, actually, with the Department of Environmental Quality. They actually do the air quality monitoring, where public health really has a role during wildfire season, and hopefully a role moving forward in, around prescribed burning and community planning, is in working with the public health system, which exists at both a local level and a state level, convening those partners to make sure that we're coordinated for response, because there's an emergency response aspect to wildfires. There is a planning and communication aspect that is critical that really takes that information that DEQ collects around air quality and then has to publicize very broadly and very rapidly what that air quality index is saying and how people can respond and take action to protect their health. That's going to be particularly important for vulnerable populations, older adults, young children, people living with a chronic disease like asthma, heart disease, chronic obstructive disease, lung disease. And so that communication piece and having that be coordinated is very important in a role that public health has played.
Does it seem to you, Kirsten, that the public has gotten a lot more savvy about the levels of danger inherent with wildfire smoke? It seems like, even before I see it getting particularly bad, it seems like people are all over Facebook with the latest air quality index.
Yeah, I do think that people certainly, when you live with it every day, and I think in particular in Southern Oregon and Northern California, there was a living with it this summer that was exceptional. And so I do think people are savvy and tracking on this. I think that's also moving across the state as people experience different levels of smoke from wildfire or prescribed burn or any kind of smoke for that matter. So I do think people are paying more attention, but it is something certainly that I think Southern Oregon has become particularly in tune to.
We are talking about new rules for prescribed fire smoke management in the state of Oregon. They went into effect on March 1st after a long process involving the three agencies we're talking to, the Oregon Health Authority, the Department of Environmental Quality, and the Oregon Department of Forestry. Nick Yonkert, ODF, is the Smoke Management Program Manager. Michael Orman is DEQ's Air Planning Program Manager. And Kirsten Aird is the Chronic Disease Manager at OHA. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Not surprised to see a few phone calls already. Boris in Eugene, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi, thanks for this topic. My question is about the hearings you had around the state. Were those mainly for you to tell us what you wanted to do, or was that for us to tell you what we wanted you to do? And the second part of the question is, did you hear anything that changed what you had originally planned to do based on your hearings?
All right. Thanks for the question, Boris. Appreciate that. Nick or Michael, want to take that on?
I can take that on, and Michael can add as well. So, Boris, thank you for that question. Essentially, we had hearings in five different places throughout the state, two on the west side and I think three on the east side, if I remember right, or in one in Southern Oregon, Medford, Klamath Falls, LaGrand, Bend, and in the Eugene area. So those areas, essentially, when we do our rulemaking, first we develop a review committee of very interested stakeholders who know the business of prescribed burning, wildfire, and so forth. And they help to frame up the discussion as to things that need to change because they are more of the experts on the issue, and they've heard from their communities and so forth. So we had review meetings, and we focused on two areas that mentioned earlier, the change in the intrusion definition and also a communication plan and community response plan. So so those are the two main areas. And so then we went out for public hearings in August to present what the committee had come up with and what the agencies had worked on to kind of finalize, at least from what we knew. And so those folks who were at the public meetings could testify based off of what we presented. So both Michael Orman and myself, we presented what the changes were going to be. And then people who were in the audience could provide written or oral testimony to our changes. And for the most part, most of the comments that we received back were positive and in support of what changes we made. One area where we did make a change at one of our board meetings based off of comments received was that that there was an ask for an exemption to the one-hour threshold for the smoke intrusion. So our smoke intrusion definition has changed where we have a short-term or a one-hour threshold and a 24-hour average standard threshold, which is basically that's tied to the National Ambient Air Quality Standards that the Environmental Protection Agency has authority over. So they felt like that essentially the 24-hour standard was basically the only one that was really rooted in science, whereas the 1 hour was a little bit more arbitrary. So they asked for an exemption if they could demonstrate that they had produced a good communication and community response plan for their area, and if they could get that approved through their local city council and the county commissioners, and then through ODF and DEQ with OHA's assistance, that they could get an exemption. So there are some communities that are seeking that exemption, and that was one of the areas that changed based off of the hearing information.
And the written comments as well. I noticed there were some concerns expressed in the written comments as well with the one-hour standard. So what was the basic rub there? What concerned people the most about the one-hour standard?
Well, essentially that we felt, especially it was presented through DEQ, that the 24-hour standard really is an average of smoke. And for prescribed burning, oftentimes our smoke comes in a more intense burst that goes through town at a pretty high level, and then it drops back down. So at the 24-hour level, the burn actually has only produced smoke into a community for 3 or 4 hours. It bumps it up, and obviously we don't breathe on a 24-hour basis. We breathe on a minute-by-minute, hour-by-hour basis. And so the concern was that we needed to have some type of threshold for that short-term smoke impact. And so even though EPA does not have a one-hour threshold standard, it just has the 24-hour, that there were some folks who felt like that since we don't have something totally rooted in science, although there is, you know, some information that basically does give us reason to believe that, you know, smoke at the short term is certainly a health concern as well, that our values for the 1 hour threshold were more arbitrary. So that was the one concern there. And so there was a compromise made, and that would be that you could have an exemption as long as you created a community response plan that would notify the residents of that smoke-sensitive area that possibility of smoke coming into the area on a particular day or how much burning was going to take place near the area so people could be prepared for it and take action to protect themselves from smoke.
So, for example, you know, Wednesday between 2 and 4, we think it's going to be pretty high. So these are the hours to avoid outdoor activity?
Exactly.
Another call here from Helga in Talent. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking Oregon's new smoke management rules with Nick Yonker from ODF, Michael Orman from DEQ, and Kirsten Aird from the Oregon Health Authority. Hi, Helga.
Perhaps this is not the way you looked at it because you're looking at smoke and the effect on humans, but I keep wondering, okay, we've had 100 years of fire suppression, so there's a lot of fuel buildup, but if we ground up the fuel instead of piling them up and burning it, we wouldn't be creating more carbon dioxide because you're using oxygen and creating carbon dioxide. So you're adding to global warming. I mean, yes, either it's a big fire or controlled fire, but still you're creating more carbon dioxide. Am I wrong?
Let's find out. Helga, thanks for that. Why don't you take that on, Michael Orman?
Sure, I can start, and maybe Nick can jump in too. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a great question about the impacts of the prescribed fire activity on CO2 emissions and global warming impacts. You know, what we've been seeing from the recent research on the topic is wildfires actually have more of an impact on our climate change than the prescribed fire activities because of the amount of fuel and the types of fuel that are burned during a wildfire versus in a controlled scenario. And so while it may have an impact and increase CO2 emissions, it ends up keeping more of the carbon sequestered in the forest than would otherwise be emitted from a wildfire.
And Nick Yonker, from the forestry perspective, is there anything to what Helga's talking about where you could grind it up, slash it out, instead of having to burn the material there?
Yeah, that's a good point. And in fact, that is done quite a bit. But what the practitioners have found that essentially that you can do that, grind it up, spread it around, remove some of it as well. But to really get the effect that you need to prevent wildfire and to help keep the forest healthy, that the final process is actually burning. So if they can utilize or do those alternatives to spread things around, that's one thing. And when removed to a certain degree, of course, that's very expensive to try to remove all the material. So that's feasibility is not very good there. But in essence, they found that really you still have to go in and burn a lot of it to make sure you get a good clean slate in order to prevent wildfire from running through there again, at least within the first few years. Of course, you're going to have to continue to treat because essentially the forest continues to produce dead material that drops onto the ground floor, and then also plants start growing again, and so you're back, and it doesn't take too long. It takes a few years, and then you're back to having to retreat and so forth. And so fire actually provides the greatest length of time between those treatments.
Yeah, that is part of the ecosystems that we were reminded exactly. Many times by forest ecologists. Cynthia and Talent is on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Nick Yonker, Michael Orman, and Kirsten Aird.
Yeah, thanks. It sounds like these folks have already made up their minds that there are going to be some prescribed burns. It's up to the citizens to protect themselves. I find that model very irresponsible. There's already a lot of smoke in the valley. We often have bad air days just from wood smoke from wood stoves that accumulates, as well as agricultural burning. And evidently, those permits for agricultural burning are super easy to get and not really enforced. And so I would love to see some discussion of how other sources of smoke and air pollution will be controlled and reduced to balance the prescribed burns.
All right. Thanks for that, Cynthia. Appreciate it. And I'm going to pitch that to you, Michael Orman, because it does raise the question, particularly in the Medford-Ashland area, which had its problem with wood smoke consistently and still has an advisory system in place. How you figure the times to find the burning of prescribed burns in the midst of that whole situation?
Yeah, the caller has a great point about the fact that our airsheds already have pollution that is in them from a number of sources. I think the caller mentioned wood stove smoke, and DEQ has many programs to try and control the emissions, reduce the emissions from wood stove activities. We have some grant programs where we work directly with communities to run those advisory programs that you mentioned, Jeff. And the objective there is to burn when we have the ability to burn and not have bad air and have to call an advisory. And we work directly with the community because they are closer to the folks that are burning in those situations. And then the caller mentioned, the agricultural burning, and that definitely does take a burden or take an amount of pollution that would otherwise be available for prescribed fires. So it's a balancing, and really our objective here is to reduce emissions from all sources, and including prescribed fire when we can. And that's definitely part of Nick Yonker's role as the smoke management coordinator and the manager of the smoke management team, to forecast where those emissions, where the pollution from prescribed fires will go, and whether it will reach levels that would be above our thresholds.
So, Nick, let me bring you in on that one, because I've always wondered how much this is like threading a needle to make the call on when and where to allow burning.
Yeah, in fact, the whole reason why there is a smoke management program is that the recognition is that our forests are going to burn in order to reduce fuel on the ground, whether it's somebody's backyard or their agricultural lands and so forth, that people need to burn. It is a hazard reduction. It's one of the most effective reduction in hazard. So burning is not burning or no burning is not an option. We are going to have burning. That's just going to be the bottom line. Our state is a fire adapted state. It has we're just going to have burning, and that means smoke. And so our program was built on that predicate that basically we're going to have smoke. So how do we do this where we impact the fewest number of people? And so that's what we try to do in our program, is that we are essentially, most of us are meteorologists. We provide weather forecasts to determine how well the smoke will lift up and the direction it will travel each and every day. And from that, there are certain communities, the larger communities in the state, that we have particular protection called smoke sensor receptor areas. We have 23 throughout the state, that we are trying to give the highest level of protection.
Oh, and those are the SSRAs, or we're talking about the smoke sensitive
receptors.
SSRAs,
exactly.
All right, those are all available online, along with all the information in the new rules, which went into effect on March 1st. Our thanks to Nick Yonker, Michael Orman, and Kirsten Aird for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.